Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Rick Recking, longtime member, currently on the membership committee, titularly part of the program committee, but I haven't been there in a bit, so I'm a little bit deadbeat there. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce themselves so that we may know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're either presented by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community, as will be the case today. I have a few announcements to read before starting the program. Prairie is the recipient of the work of a four-year history committee that created two-volume set of our history. These volumes are still for sale, and speak to Mary Mullen if you'd like a copy of them. It's late in the winter, but it'll get you to the spring. had another one. Renee.
Hi, I'm Renee. Update from the search committee, and if you have noticed, it's also there are updates in the Prairie Fire and also the news, but the major thing is we got our congregational record up. Huzzah! And after Herculean effort, it's 42 questions long, and they're very complex questions. We use the survey results to help inform that. And the survey, speaking of, we had a 68% response rate, which is honestly the highest response rate I've ever seen from any survey ever. So thank you to everyone who filled out the survey. We didn't get any questions. The UUA has to approve our record before it's actually posted. And we didn't get any hey, you need to change this, or we have questions about this. Which, again, I think really a testament to the work of the search committee. So keep looking for updates. We are not allowed to tell you any names or identifying information about any potential candidates or candidates. So do not ask us. We will not tell you. But we can tell you where we are in the process. So that's what we're going to be doing, is keep telling you where we are in the process of this. So thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Renee. Just to inform any guests or visitors, the search is for a new minister.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I noticed on the right-hand column of our order of service that Patty has an announcement for us.
I just wanted to remind people that I brought your auction letters, and they're right outside the door. They're alphabetical. And also, there's a few, if you're interested in buying more things, there's a remaining list out there as well, but I'll send that out by email.
How much money?
Wow. And we raised that, thank you, $15,000.
That's the part I was hoping to get to. While Oak Park Place does have a parking lot, it's not for us. Please park on the street, and the parking spaces on back here are for the loved ones of the residents here who come to visit. If you've parked in the lot, we respectfully ask you to move it now. I've been parking up in the dentist's place up the street. I haven't had any problems yet. The opening words will be read by Susan Gernitz.
I'm Suzanne Gernant. And the opening words are, "The earth is warming." They're written by Susan Davis and Archer. I'm backing up. "The earth is warming. The birdsong increases. The sweeter breezes brush our cheeks. And the earth holds hope in its seeds and buds. Come, let us gather this morning with joyful noise, with warm hearts, and with hopeful spirits. For we are one with the renewal of the earth, and blessedly held in the love of one another."
Thank you, Suzanne. If you'll notice, there's very little in the way of music on the program today. But one we do have now is the opening song, Ten Little Dinosaurs, and the lyrics will be onto the screen.
I think they're on the screen, but you'll kind of... I think the lyrics on the screen might be good. Oh, yeah, can you plug it in? Okay, so the tune is... You'll get the tune right away. You don't have to stand up. You can stay seated. The kids are welcome to. My daughter hopefully will dance a little bit. But this is 10 little dinosaurs to fit with our theme today.
Did you want me to move them at all?
Stegosaurus. One little, two little, three little dinosaurs. Four little, five little, six little dinosaurs. Seven little, eight little, nine little dinosaurs. 10 little dinosaur babies. Triceratops. Dinosaurs, four little, five little, six little dinosaurs, seven little, eight little, nine little dinosaurs, 10 little dinosaur babies. Pterodactyl. One little, two little, three little dinosaurs, four little, five little, six little dinosaurs, seven little, eight little, nine little dinosaurs, 10 little dinosaur babies. Brontosaurus. One little, two little, three little dinosaurs, four little, five little, six little dinosaurs, seven little, eight little, nine little dinosaurs, 10 little dinosaur babies. Tyrannosaurus Rex. One little, two little, three little dinosaurs, four little, five little, six little dinosaurs, seven little, eight little, nine little dinosaurs, 10 little dinosaur babies.
And so we maybe didn't mention too, this is a intergenerational service, so for all ages, so hence why they had the little dinosaur song. So
thank you, everybody sounded great. Our chalice lighting this morning will be led by Johanna Hatch and Avon Creed.
And this comes from the Oberlin UU Fellowship in Oberlin, Ohio. We light this chalice to find inner peace, love for each other, and faith in ourselves. Also to be welcoming to whomever we meet, and kind to all living creatures. So gather around this light of hope as we share this time together.
Thank you. Thank you. We have an opportunity now for a few moments of silent meditation. Story for all ages. Stick and Stone by Tom Lichtenheld.
Doing it, Renee?
What?
You doing it?
Oh yeah, I kind of need a microphone though.
Should I plug it in or no? Okay.
All right, so this is Stick and Stone by Tom Lichtenheld and Beth Ferry. So I thought again, the stone had to do with our speaker today talking about geological history in Wisconsin. So this is Stick. And this is Stone. Lonely and alone. a 0, a 1. Alone is no fun. Stick, stone, along comes pine cone. Makes fun of stone. That was nice. Won't leave him alone. Vanish, says stick. His word does the trick. Stone whispers, gee, you stuck up for me. That's just what sticks do. Friends do it too. Stick, stone, no longer alone. Stick, stone, a friendship has grown. They wander, explore. Lays by the shore. What happens then?
There's a storm.
Yeah, then thunder and rain. A loud hurricane. Boom! Uh-oh, stick is windblown. There goes pinecone. Hold on! Calls stone. Oh. Again, he's alone. Search day and search night. Stick? Stick! Stick! No stick in sight. What's this? A huge puddle. Stick is stuck in the muddle. Stone rescues him quick. If you can't see, Stone rolls down the hill and then splashes into the puddle. Kersplash! Quick thinking. You rock, Stone, says Stick. That's just what stones do. Best friendship rocks too. Stick, Stone, together again. Stick, Stone, a perfect 10. To the end. And then the pine cone says, sorry, I needled you so much. And that is Stick and Stone.
The young people might want to stay here because we have some exhibits to show you.
Today's presentation, Stories in Stone by Brooke Norsted. That's Brooke. Brooke grew up in the foothills of the Chugach Mountains in Anchorage, Alaska. She's walked on glaciers, excavated dinosaurs, uncovered ancient amphibian footprints, examined lake sediments, and explored the backcountry of Arches National Park. Brooke is currently the assistant director for the UW Geology Museum, and while she doesn't live in the mountains anymore, she loves teaching people about Wisconsin's surprising geological past. This presentation relates to our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we're part. We will have time for a brief discussion afterwards. And does Brooke have a microphone?
I do.
Yeah.
It's even live.
Take it away.
All right. I'm going to just start my timer here because I tend to get a little chat and keep myself on our time. So thank you so much for having me to your group today. I really appreciate being invited. And how many people have been to the Geology Museum before? Right? About half of you, great.
Well, you should always come back. And those of you who haven't been to the museum, we're on the UW campus. We're close to Union South. We're free. The hardest part of visiting the museum is parking. So I apologize for that in advance. But I came today to talk about stories in stones because geologists, this is how we think about rocks, whether or not it's like on a big scale of like looking at landforms and where they are versus even looking down at a like individual mineral crystal. We use all of that information to help us understand the Earth better and the history of the Earth. And so also being the daughter of a librarian, I tend to think in terms of stories and books. And so that's why I like, and I, you know, as social creatures, we like hearing stories too. So that's how I come to this topic and why I present it in this way. So just my first little slide here. So here's the Geology Museum. If you like dinosaurs, we've got those. And we also have rocks that glow in the dark. So you should definitely come visit us. This is one of my favorite authors and artists. His name is Ray Troll. I have a soft spot because he's also from Alaska. But he does these really fun illustrations. And I love this because this really speaks to, I like to think of this as a stack of books. Right? And so this is the timeline of basically the last, well, yeah, here he takes you all the way back to 4.6 billion years ago when the Earth formed. But really, he's kind of starting the timeline. He's blown up the last 500 million years, more or less. And so what I want to do is I want to shift this a little bit, because this is usually how, when you see geologic time, this is what they show you. And they're really focusing on the last bit of it. So I'm gonna, a little bit of foundation here before we get into Wisconsin geology, is I want you to imagine that my height is the history of the Earth. And so where my feet touch the ground is when the Earth formed 4.56 billion years ago. And then the top of my head is today. And so we'll use that to kind of hang some of these Wisconsin stories off of. But just for a little context, this part that you usually get to hear a lot about, because it's really when we get a lot of great fossils, so here back to about 450 million years ago, that's your face on this timeline. So this is about 450 million years ago, and this is today. And that always begs the question, like, what's going on down here? Right? So we'll get into that a little bit. But I also want to give you this sense of, we use the words millions and billions, they're all big, right? Just one letter different. How different could those be? So I want you to think of millions, and I want you to imagine that you could count to a million, right? Just one number every second. And so if you did that, and you didn't stop to eat, you didn't sleep, it would take you about 12 and a half days to get to a million. So to count to a billion, doing the same method, counting 1 second, one number every second, takes you over 33 years.
Oh.
So these are really different, right? Very different. And so that's how, you know, 4.5 billion, where our Earth forms, right? That's a long time ago. When we're thinking about dinosaurs, that's like here. That's your nose to your eyebrows. So even though it's easy to think dinosaurs were so long ago, and whenever I do this with kids and adults, I'll walk us through this. People always put them at your navel. I don't know, dinosaurs, that was a long time ago. Must be about here. But dinosaurs went extinct at your eyebrows on this timeline. Okay. So what I love about this is you don't have to remember numbers, right? You can just kind of keep things in perspective as to how old everything is. So we're going to talk about three chapters in Wisconsin's history. Because when you go around the world, you know, a geologist would love it if you could go to one spot and from bottom to top, you could get the whole record, right? There would be rocks representing all of the time back to 4.5 billion years, but that's not how it works. And so it makes it more interesting that you have to go to different places to piece together the story. So even here in Wisconsin, the three parts I'm going to tell you about are really different time periods, and it's like the chapters in between have been torn out. They've been eroded away. So while we all love dinosaurs, we don't find dinosaur fossils here in Wisconsin because those rocks are gone. They've been eroded away. So the first question a geologist or a paleontologist asks when they want to study something is, where do I have to go to find those rocks or those fossils? And so they have to think about, like, where is an outcrop? Where at the surface of the earth are there rocks of the right age for me to go look at if I'm interested in dinosaurs? So when we go look for dinosaurs as part of the museum, we go to Wyoming. And so we drive about 2 days away. And so Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, Utah, those are places in North America that you can find dinosaurs, but not here in Wisconsin. But we have some other cool fossils, and I'll show you those too. So this is also a favorite author of mine. And so this just builds into this concept of reading rocks. And this is really what geologists do. So rocks are records of events that took place at the time they formed. They are books. They have a different vocabulary, a different alphabet that you learn how to read them. And that's why people go to school to study geology, right? You're learning how to read those rocks. Whether it's you become a geochemist and you're looking at things on the smallest scale, you're putting individual mineral crystals into a fancy machine to figure out how old they are, or what they can tell us about the oxygen content of the atmosphere 4 billion years ago. It can be that. It could be, I'm going to be studying the Himalayas and how they formed. So all of those are different alphabets, effectively, that we learn as geologists. All right, so our first stop when we're thinking about Wisconsin, this is one of my favorite maps of Wisconsin, and it's a landform map. And so here you can see kind of some of the broader themes you can see on our state. So down here, of course, this is the Driftless area, right, that we all love to drive through and pick apples in. You can see up in northern Wisconsin that it's a little bumpy. You can see some of the hills up there. There are some flat areas here, right? We're going to start where I've drawn this heart. And so that, in fact, is around your navel. So this is about 1.75 billion years ago in what is now Wisconsin. But this is a time when the Earth looked really different than it does today. The surface of our Earth is dynamic. It's always moving. The crust of the Earth is cracked and broken and is always shifting. And so while here in Wisconsin we don't have earthquakes, places like Alaska or California, that's where you hear about earthquakes happening. And that's because that's where some of these cracks in the Earth's crust are. Now, if you go far enough back, we used to have that sort of thing happening here in the middle part of what is now North America. Right? And so if we head to this area, there's actually a tiny little town here called Red Granite, Wisconsin. And it gets that name because what they dig up out of the ground there is, we're going to stay consistent, is red granite. So this is actually a quarry in Red Granite, Wisconsin. If you could walk up and touch that rock, it would be this. And so, yeah, so you can see in here, this is a polished side, right? You can see, so we did that. We made it all shiny. But this is kind of the rough, raw face of red granite. Now, when a geologist sees granite, what they see is a volcano. They see not just a volcano, but the belly of a volcano. Because this is, let's see, I'm going to put it down here. And in fact, you kids, how many colors do you see in there?
Lots. Red. I see like two colors.
Two colors? What colors?
Black and gray and white.
And white. Yeah, so we have red, black, gray, and white. And so if we could kind of pull all the minerals out of that, so minerals are like the ingredients in rock. I like to think of this as a cookie, and these are the ingredients. So here we can see these are big versions of the crystals that are in there. So this is called feldspar, this is called mica, and this is quartz. Yeah, it looks like a diamond, right? If this was a diamond, though, I would probably be in Mexico right now. Because it'd be worth a lot of money, right? So we have these three minerals. Minerals are the ingredients of rocks. To get that kind of rock, what we need is to bury these deep inside the earth, inside of a magma chamber. And so if you do that, if you get them inside the magma chamber, they would melt because it's so hot in there. And then we think of volcanoes, we think of them erupting, right? And so if you did that, if you burped up and blew some of this stuff out of the belly of the volcano, it would cool really quickly. And you would just get this kind of light pink rock. You wouldn't be able to see the three different colors in there unless you cut it and you looked at it under a microscope. And that's what geologists do too. They look at stuff super close. But here, we can actually see all those crystals in there. And what that means is that it cooled slowly. And it cooled inside of the volcano. It's like if you were cooking or baking cookies and you turned off your oven, it would slowly cool down, right? If you went back the next day, it still wouldn't be 375 degrees. Same with volcanoes. Of course, you can't go up and like push a button and turn a volcano off. But over time, they stop erupting, and we say they go extinct. And then all of that hot, melted material inside the belly of the volcano will slowly cool off. It'll take thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of years to cool. But as it does that, all those minerals have more time to grow and get big. And so that's why we can see them in here, is because they had that time. They cooled inside of a volcano. And so any rock that has done that, with minerals that cool inside a volcano, we use the word granite. So whenever you see, you know, the word granite, that's what it means to a geologist. It might not mean that to somebody who makes countertops, because people have sent me pictures of all kinds of things that are in their countertops that are called granite and are not actually granite. But for a geologist, that's what that means, is it's basically these three ingredients that have cooled inside a magma chamber. You can go to the Capitol building and you can see there's big columns made of red granite, right? And so this all comes from the central part of our state, and we can see the granite now at the surface. But this used to be the belly of a volcano. It used to be buried like a mile underground. And so not only is the volcano gone, the part that looks like a mountain, that has washed away, but all the rock above that has washed away. And now we just have what used to be buried deep underground. So whenever we see granite, that's what a geologist thinks. They're like, oh, there were volcanoes here, but it was a long time ago. And then you can think of, you know, if this is when we can date this rock, we can figure out how old, like when it crystallized, when it cooled, and that gives us that date of 1.675 billion years. So you can see that's a long time ago. We've had a lot of time to have that, the volcano and all that rock erode away. And now we have it at the surface. So that's one of our chapters. Is pretty deep, and it tells us we used to have volcanoes here. It looks like rock, doesn't it? Yeah. Got a couple others. So this is a picture of them quarrying it out. Super sketchy. Looks very dangerous. Here's another one. So there's a lot of buildings in Wisconsin that you can see that have red granite as a building material in them, not just the Capitol building. Granite is a great building material. It's very strong. Polishes up really nicely. So here you can see a bunch of bricks, right? Kind of building stones, cutting granite blocks, Montello, Wisconsin. So just to kind of get back to how this happens. So here we're kind of looking through a slice of the earth. Right? This is the crust. It's just the thinnest. I think of it as like a candy coating. It's just a shell on the outside. It's stable enough. We walk around on it. It's miles thick. But compared to how big our Earth is, it's very thin. And so it's just in these spots where you can see there's cracks at the crust. And what's happening in these spots is where you have these cracks and one piece of crust is getting shoved underneath. And when it does that, it kind of gets recycled, and you get some melting that happens, and that melting is what feeds volcanoes often. And so that's what's happening in here. So that melted rock is not coming from the core. It's not coming from the very inside. This is all happening in that skin of the earth on the outside. Okay. Now, if we hop to our second spot, we're zooming forward in time. It's like we're in a time machine. We're hopping up to our mouths, right? And this, you can really go anywhere around here and you're going to be having the same story. I decided to kind of jump over to the Lake Michigan shoreline, but really all of this down here, the rocks that you could go outside and find in the ground, there's a great spot behind the target on PD that you can look for fossils. Hint, hint, that's where I point everybody. But this is the Lake Michigan shoreline. And so the beige kind of rocks that you find around here, those were laid down. That used to be mud at the bottom of an ocean. And so we like to think right now, you know, it's March, people are thinking about spring break, going to the beach, right? At this time, about 450 million years ago, we would have been the ideal spring break location, right? Tropical seas, nice, warm. You would have wanted to take your snorkel because there wasn't much life on land at that point. So you want to go out in the oceans because that's where all the action's happening. And so this is a model, but you can see some of the creatures that lived at that time. So these are relatives of modern squid and octopus. They all look a little weird, don't they? So, yeah, it's basically an octopus shoved into a shell. And so what we find is the shell of these creatures. So I have one of these. So this is just a chunk of a shell. And what we find around here, typically, we don't find the shells themselves. What we find is, like, all the mud that got squished into the shell, and then the shell disappeared. And we get this plug of mud that's left behind. So this is part of one of these creatures. This one probably would have been about like 4 feet long. Some of them would have gotten over 12 feet long. So really big. Maybe it was a baby or a young one. You can hold on to that. And then we see all kinds of other sea creatures in here. These are called crinoids or sea lilies. There are all kinds of like seashells down on the bottom here. There's corals. And so what we find now are just kind of these fossil hashes where you just get a whole bunch of critters that are all kind of collected together. And I'll have all these over here so after the service you can come up and look and touch and everything. So a curious thing is that you can stand at a pile of rocks like on Highway 18 heading out to Mount Horeb. You can see these piles of beige rocks like this. And you can stand there and you can see it's just rock, 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 rock. And then you'll find this like layer of fossils. And then it's blank again. It's like rock, 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 rock. And so how that's interpreted is that there were these, at this time, about 450 million years ago, North America was down on its side and Wisconsin was actually close to the equator. So again, great spring break location. So at that time, you have big tropical storms that would roll through. And so all of the wind would and the storm would kick up all that water and mud, and then all the heavy stuff settles out. So all the fossils would settle out first, all the shells, and then you would get the mud settling on top of it. And so this concentration is a byproduct of these storms that would happen at that time. So let's see what else I have for. So tropical destination. This is what we can find now. So here you can just see it's a whole bunch of different things. This is like that squid fossil that I have down here. These are snail shells. This is a coral. This is just a seashell called a brachiopod. So there's a bunch, and they're all just kind of in that layer because of these storms that would go through and kick up all the shells. All right, the last chapter, we're going to jump up into my hair. And so that's the Ice Age. And so you'll notice again, like I said, dinosaurs were nose to eyebrows, right? So we basically, in our state, we have rocks that are from here, and then we really don't have much, we don't have anything in our state from in here. And so it's really the Ice Age that we start to see deposits again. And so the last chapter in our story today, we get fossils from it, and I brought along some examples of those, but really a lot of the evidence is the landforms that we see. And so when you drive from Madison to Milwaukee, you cross through and over a lot of these like gentle rolling hills, and those are called drumlins. And if you could fly over them instead of drive through them, you would see that they're all from the sky, they're these teardrop shapes. And so they have kind of like their fat bottom part to the south, and then they've got this like trail to the north. And between Madison and Milwaukee is, there's one other place in the world that has such a good drumlin field. So people fly, geologists fly into Wisconsin from around the world to study these drumlins. There's Poland is the other spot. So if we go back up, so all of this area down here is full of these drumlins. And then even if you go sledding at Elver, right? So the drumlins are formed underneath these glaciers. And then at Elver, that's a spot where when the ice, so during the Ice Age, North America, much of North America was covered by a sheet of ice. And so here in Wisconsin, much of our state was covered by ice. Here in Madison, if you had walked up onto the sheet of ice, you could have walked to the North Pole without getting off of ice. So this is a big, big blanket of ice that covered North America. And it ended, part of the edge of it was here in Wisconsin. And so that's what you're even seeing when you see the edge of the Driftless here. That's basically where the ice ended. And so if you could zoom out to all of North America, you can trace the edge of this ice sheet all the way across kind of the northern part of the United States. But here in Wisconsin, it made an end moraine at the end. So all that ice sits there, and ice is always flowing forward, right? So it's always plastically deforming and flowing forward. And it's easy to think of it as like a bulldozer, and it's just like pushing all the sediment in front of it. But it's not. It's a dump truck. And so it's picking up sediment, and it's carrying it with it, and then when the ice melts, it drops. So if you could get a giant vacuum cleaner, and you could just suck up all of the deposits that the ice dropped when it melted, you could take that and you could just vacuum up all along here, suddenly the rest of our state would look like that. And so it's not that it like knocked down all of this texture, it filled it up with deposits. And so those glaciers, they flowed down through our state, and then they stalled out here, right? And so in Madison, if you go to Elver Park, that hill you slid down is one of these places where the ice sat there for a while, and it, again, was always flowing forward, so it's always bringing new dirt and soil and rocks to the edge, and it's melting there. So it's basically just staying in one place. It's a conveyor belt that's staying in one spot, and it's just dumping all of that stuff off the front. And so you end up with a big mound. And so geologists call that a moraine. And so if you go to Pope Farm for sunflower days, that also is a moraine. And so those are spots where that ice kind of stalls out for a little bit. And so it's looking at those landforms here in southern Wisconsin. So here you have, that's like a funky-shaped drumlin. And here, the Ice Age Trail is a trail that you can hike that follows as well as it can where the farthest extent of that ice. And so here you can see, during the last Ice Age, this is where the ice stalled out. So right in Madison, this is the spot where it stopped. Now, the other thing that happens, and this is a bigger story, but I'm going to tell you the short version of it, is this ice also plugs up rivers. And so the Wisconsin River, of course, flows through the central part of our state, and it typically it used to go right through where Devil's Lake is now. It used to go through the Baraboo Hills, but then when this ice came through, it plugged up all of that water from the Wisconsin River, and it dammed it up. And so it made a giant lake here that we call Glacial Lake Wisconsin. And so that whole area, if you drive to Minneapolis, and you're driving through this area, and you see these like big rock towers, but it's pretty flat. That used to be the bottom of a lake during the Ice Age. All this water got piled up here. Sometimes it got piled up so far, you know, that lake got so big that the water would actually go out the Black River. But for the most part, it sat here. But then that ice moves, it melts, and you get this flood. And so the Dells, that's a spot where all of that water rushed through, and in a matter of probably days, maybe a couple of weeks, carved out the Dells. And so that is this kind of epic proportion flood. And this happened all across North America. In Minnesota, it was Glacial Lake Agassiz. And the Minnesota River, today it's this, you know, modest-sized river, but the valley it's in is huge. And that's because that valley was carved by this big flood of Glacial Lake Agassiz. Over in Montana and Washington State, it was another one. So all along the front of this glacier, you had these dammed up lakes that then flooded out. And it took basically until people could fly over these areas to be able to recognize these patterns and tell these stories of all of these glacial lakes flooding. So this is a terminal moraine, so this is like an Elver. So again, that's the spot where, you know, it seems flat, and then you just get this big hill. And so that's where all that ice-deposited sediments. Up north, you get these lakes called Kettle Lakes that used to be just big chunks of ice that fell off the front of the glacier and just sat there and melted. And so that was the seed of a future lake. And then there's the Dells. So these are all landforms that we see and we interpret as geologists. So, in summary, some resources if you want to become a better rock reader. You know, there's great books. The Roadside Geology of Wisconsin is a great one that was written by an emeritus professor at the department. And then there's a lot of places to explore. I will be here afterwards to answer questions, and I have a lot of specimens. I brought along fossils from the Ice Age, so you can come look at those as well. But I'm happy to entertain any questions if now's an appropriate time.
Could you show us a dinosaur bone?
Oh, yeah, so not dinosaur. These are, so this makes me look super strong. But any of you kids could lift this up too. This is made out of foam, but it's a replica of the mastodon thigh bone that's in the geology museum. So that mastodon that's in our museum was discovered in the late 1890s by kids in southwestern Wisconsin. And so a lot of times it's not scientists who make discoveries, it's like people who have land and explore, and then they bring something in, they're like, hey, what's this thing? And so it was after big storms in the 1890s that bones were exposed. So this is equivalent to like your thigh bone. This is the left thigh bone. So it's this one. This is the ball joint. So that's why you can dance, right? Because you've got this ball joint in your hip. This one's a copy. The real one we took off display so we could take some of the bone out of it to figure out how old it was. And then we made some copies before we put it back. Yeah, so this one is, you can even see, it's kind of made out of a foam. Yeah. So this is a mastodon bone. Mastodons and mammoths were cousins. Mammoths are more popular and like in Ice Age the movie and whatnot, but they're both like hairy elephant relatives during the Ice Age. And the other things I have sitting here are teeth. So I have replica teeth and then one real tooth. So this is a tooth of a mastodon. One tooth. I know. Whoppers, right? The tooth fairy. That's a good tooth there. Now, this is the chewing surface right here, and then this is the root, right? So that's the part, if it smiled at you, you would see this part. Now, this is a mammoth tooth, and one tooth. So mammoths only have four teeth in their mouth. So kind of one in each area. And this is basically what an elephant tooth looks like too. Yeah, and so this is the chewing surface, and then this is the root down here. And so despite looking really similar, mastodons and mammoths, they lived at the same time. And these are enormous animals that have to eat a lot of food. And so they ate really different food, both plant eaters, but this would, mastodons lived in the forest and ate twigs and tree branches. And then,
the computer decided to.
And then mammoths lived on the prairie and the plains and ate grass. And so they didn't have to directly compete for food, which was ultimately good because they needed a lot of it. We had both in our state. That mammoth bones have been found in our state too. And our mastodon in the museum doesn't show any signs of being, well, the bones don't reveal any butchering or being hunted. However, there was, years after the initial discovery of some of those bones, somebody came forward who claimed that there was an arrowhead that he gave to the museum that was found with the mastodon bones. And so while the bones themselves don't reflect being hunted, you know, there's this story of an arrowhead being associated with it. There's mammoth bones in our state that show signs of butchering. So you can see kind of cut marks on the bone where meat was harvested off of them, because it's a big animal and it would certainly feed people a long time. So humans were in our state at the same time as these creatures.
Will you entertain a few questions?
Absolutely.
I'll bring the microphone to whomever.
Thank you, Brooke.
Yeah.
I just want to say that Roadside Geology book of Wisconsin is super duper if you don't have it. It's like Mary and I have a copy at home. We also have them from Minnesota, a lot of the different states. Mm-hmm. And it's like by road marker.
Yeah.
So you're going along the highway and you got highway marker number 35 and it talks about the geology. That's right.
Yeah. It's like you're going on a road trip with me. My family loves it. Bob Dott and John Attig. Yeah, and so Bob Dott was a member of the other UU. But he passed away last year.
Do you want to demonstrate where on the body humans are?
Yeah, right. So, yeah, humans are all going to be like up right here, scalp level.
I was wondering what your opinion as a geologist is about the current debate over environmental concerns. Because I know that there have been a number of major extinctions in the past, and without saying that we shouldn't be taking care of our environment, of course we ought to be and probably won't be, but I'm wondering if part of the issue here is just that we're afraid of change and what that would mean for us. I mean, is there really a serious concern that this planet is going to become a dead place? Mm. Or is it just that it's going to be changed and transformed? Mm-hmm.
I don't have any concerns about our planet and its survival. It's our species. And I think that's shared among a lot of geologists. You know, like our planet has made it through all kinds of trials and tribulations. The reason we have a moon is because a Mars-sized object hit our Earth about 4.5 billion years ago and knocked off the moon. And so, and more evidence indicates that we've had life on our planet for certainly 3.5 billion years, but it was microbial life. So I'm not worried about our planet or even life on our planet. But we're not doing a great job looking out for humans sustainably living on our planet, in my opinion.
Hi, I am a tour guide at the Capitol.
Yeah.
And so we point out the red granite every day. However, they told us to say Waupaca, so I'm confused about Montello or Waupaca.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
I've heard it called Wausau red granite.
Wow, so
Waupaca.
Maybe we'll just say it's our state stone.
Right, yeah. And you know what, sometimes, I don't know, like how granular the details are, like, I don't know. I don't feel like you're doing harm by Waupaca, right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Waupaca, of course, is a county.
was curious if there are any geologists working on the geology of the moon.
Yes, absolutely. So geologists, the word geology means the study of Earth, but there are totally geologists who study the moon and Mars, any of the terrestrial planets. Absolutely. And it's, in fact, I remember being surprised, but like, you know, what the one of the major questions they had when we went to the moon was, what's the geology of the moon and understanding the rocks? Yeah.
I have people in my life that don't believe how old the Earth is.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't have a need to persuade them of anything.
Sure.
You make a wonderful presentation, and I kind of would appreciate your advice. How do you talk to people like that?
Sure, yeah. I talk to a fair number of people who have different opinions about, yeah, the age of the Earth and evolution. So I worked at the museum 16 years, and when I started off, I used to be really worried about groups that would come and might have, they would push me on that, right? And what made me nervous is I felt like I had one shot to make one good argument to change their mind. And I've learned that that's not true. Nobody changes their mind with one persuasive argument. And so that has like released some of that burden off of me to like have the perfect argument. And instead, I think of myself as like part of a pearl necklace, where the only way that somebody, I think, changes their mind about something that's so core, right? Because, you know, that person has those opinions for a whole bunch of reasons, probably reaching back to their childhood, right? And so what I think of is I can just be a kind person who can answer questions and try to the best of my ability to, like, connect with them, and then I will be, if they ever do kind of shift how they think, I will be one piece of that story, how they got there, but I'm not going to be the person that they're going to leave and go like, you know what, that's right. And really, if somebody changed their mind that quickly about something so core to themselves, I don't know, somebody else is going to make a different persuasive argument, shift them another way. So that's how I view it now, and that's how I explain it to my tour guides, who also sometimes can be a little worried about that. And I honestly take that as part of my duty as like somebody who works at the UW, because there's this, you know, there are people who live in other parts of the state who have opinions about Madison in general, the UW-Madison in particular, and if I can just be somebody who is kind and interacts with them and helps them, then that's a win in my book. And so that's how, but I have particular, if you want to talk later too about other ways to talk and answer certain questions, I can chat with you about that. But philosophically, that's how I take it now. It's just, I'm a person in their life.
Thank you, Brooke. She'll be available for questions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
We finally get to hear from Amber again. It's our offering. It'll be shared this morning with the Tenant Resource Center. next week, where I'm assured we're going to have hymns. And now it's time as a caring community to share our joys and concerns. And if someone will carry the microphone, I'll light the candles as they're expressed.
Well, I guess my joy is how well we did with the auction.
Yeah. It's spring. Bicycling. Get your bike out. And we get to go sugaring this afternoon.
We're going to get some, right?
No, it's my tiny bit.
Oh, we do have some.
I wanted to just say a quick joy that it was so much fun to have you all as the audience for the auction last week, and thank you all for bidding high and making it so much a fun experience. And I do have a concern about the coronavirus. I was supposed to speak at the Chicago Houseware Show next week, which attracts 60,000 people from 47 countries, and they canceled it. And we're seeing more and more things canceled and changes that may impact the arts in our community and around the world. And international friendship and travel, and so I'm feeling a level of anxiety about it that I really didn't need on top of the political year that we're having.
Hi, Kate is here today, and I want everyone to think good thoughts. On Wednesday is her 50th birthday, and she is planning on having a glass of champagne on the Eiffel Tower on Wednesday, so everybody. My joy is being here and how much I enjoyed the meeting. This was my first meeting in many years of Unitarian Universalists.
Great. Would you introduce yourself? Because that's next on the agenda.
I guess I got ahead of things. My name is Anna Poplavska.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome, Anna.
Turning to the auction theme, one of my concerns has been the fact how hard Paula has had to work to get volunteers for the feeding the homeless at Grace Episcopal, because Hale's getting up in the middle of the night. So I decided to emphasize this in my auction offering and would encourage people to think more about helping out with the homeless breakfast. And lo and behold, Pam said, let's do it. So we did that yesterday.
Here, here.
Thank you. Turn it off. Turn it back on.
The coronavirus, of course, could affect our presence here at any time. The community here at Oak Park Place, Patty was kind of wondering, you know, they may want us not to meet here, and I hope we have a plan for that.
We can't just cancel.
What's that?
We could just cancel for a few weeks.
What? We could. But I mean, I think we should be maybe prepared for that. Anyway, good luck to everybody on this. Hope you've got your toilet paper. And for any joys or concerns that haven't been expressed, I light the last candle here.
And soap.
And now, chance for guests and visitors to introduce themselves. Thank you, Anna. And seeing nothing, we can move on. That's the end of our program today. Greet your neighbor. Fist bump or elbow thing. And if you handled this, be sure to wash your hands. So thanks. Thanks for coming.